Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 24th, 2002. Today's session is titled, Communicating Across Cultures, Session 3, Communicating Well Across the Sexes. It is presented by Jeff Kirsten Grip. The number is KGJ2002-08. Let's listen in.
Well, good morning. That's a cultural symbol, you know. That's what teachers use along with, okay. That has all these little meanings attached to it. I can use okay in my classes and students know that means shut up, start now. You don't have to say all those things because they sound less friendly. They're less face friendly, you know, to walk in a classroom and say, shut up. It's not acceptable. Welcome to the last in a series on intercultural communication. Last week we talked about a couple sessions about what it means to carry American identity, what people see on you, even if you don't see it on yourself when you're traveling in other cultures. Then we had three sessions on what it means to be interculturally competent, what happens when cultures collide or when people from different cultures meet, how to do that more competently, and then how to maintain relationships and friendships across cultural boundaries. And this week we focused just on sex, just on sexual differences and how to communicate across them. First day of this session we talked about how we get socialized, talked into masculinity and femininity. Men tend to be talked into masculinity, women tend to be talked into femininity. Yesterday, as I think virtually all of you know, we talked about some of the consequences of those different gender lects, how we learn to speak and comprehend and understand what each other are doing, some of the problems that arise, some of the places where we often butt heads without trying, even though we're all well-meaning people. And then today I want to talk about trying to put the two pieces together. I'm going to go to the research on intercultural communication competence, how I could be competent in, say, Thailand, and see whether that would help me be competent with women. For example, I'm going to apply some of the same kinds of thinking and see if those kinds of thinking maybe come with fewer costs than some of you were mentioning at the end of yesterday's session, and maybe actually give you all the bang for your buck, but they don't cost you very much. Let's hope that way. I want to introduce here, before I review a little bit, here's a notion that I find pretty interesting. Oh, I hate this overhead. Let's see, let me turn off one of these. Powell says that when you're coming to be competent, you really start from a position of unconscious incompetence. Most people. That you're goofy at it and you don't know it. And I would argue that most of you and I live here, conscious incompetence, where you're in interaction with somebody else, you recognize that something isn't going as it should, but you're not quite sure what that is or why that's happening. You at least have an awareness that, wow, my stomach feels bad. What's wrong here? That's what Howell would label conscious incompetence. Then you move to conscious competence, where you become totally vigilant about all your communication with somebody else. You know, hi, why did I say that? Why did I say it that way? What does she mean? She didn't say hi back. What does that mean? You know, you just have this whole, it's the thing you think about all the time. And then eventually it gets to be like riding a bike, where it becomes more a sense of unconscious competence, where it just goes again to the back of your mind. And you find yourself in what you would call a cross-cultural situation, and you know what to do. You're comfortable. Just like when your bike starts to tip over, you know how to correct for it. It's the same kind of thing that happens, according to Howell. And I kind of like this model. We're going to explore a little bit about... I looked at one thing and meant to say another. We're going to explore a little bit about this notion of conscious incompetence a little bit later on today. So I want to start with that. I also want to refresh your memory about my particular bias. I'm not objective about this stuff. I'm thinking about communication as really the key to a lot of this stuff. That granted, there may be some biological influences on my gender role. There may also be some cultural influences on my gender role. But I can present a pretty good argument that how I communicate with Karen,
hi,
has a lot to do with gender roles and with the culture. That a large part of what we do is negotiate this stuff with each other in our communication. That it's not something done to us, it's something done by us. And that cultures don't survive and thrive without support from individuals. You might think about the Holden culture as an example, which pieces have remained constant over the years. And a lot of that has to do with what sorts of symbols keep getting reused here. What kinds of things do we do that always have some kind of meaning for the people involved and tie us together? So I'm thinking again of communication is really important this process. The other piece, the other thing I like communication, as I said the last couple days, is I find it really hopeful that I can't change my biology. Culture feels a little remote from me, but my interpersonal interactions, I have a lot of control over those. Not total control. I'm constrained by what society says I can, can't, and you know, shouldn't do. But that within that, there's a lot of room for me to make changes if I want to. So I'm thinking about communication as a complex social negotiation, but that's really what's going on. It's just not just a matter of throwing words at each other. And looking at what the person said, you know, throwing some of them back. There's a lot going on. We use the metaphor of, you know, clicking on a message and seeing all the properties that are there in the message about several things. So one of the ways it's complex is that you can think of every message that you share with another person has a couple different levels. There's the level of content where you can pay attention to the words or the nonverbal symbol or whatever it is and know what that means. Okay, please take out the garbage. You understand those words are sort of a declarative sentence that wants you to do something. But at the other level, and this is the really interesting level, we're also always commenting to each other about the relationship as we see it. So if I ask you to take out the garbage, you might harump at me a little bit and think, well, who are you to tell me to take out the garbage? Okay? Or you might not say that. You might say something like, I'll do it later. Okay, so we have very competent ways of negotiating this stuff with each other. But none of this stuff is said out loud. I don't say, I have the right to tell you to take out the garbage. You don't have the right to tell me to take out the garbage. You know, that kind of stuff happens in bad melodrama. It doesn't happen in actual communication. We're much more clever than that. We tend to cloak it. So in every message now, not just the ones where we pick it up, but the argument is every message has this stuff available in it to unpack, and that we're very good, to differing degrees, unpackers of each other's communication. So that's one sense in which it's complex. I thought I wrote context there. I was going to have to change my words. The second sense in which it's complex is it really involves this identity management, that I'm negotiating who I want you to see me as in my communication, and you're doing the same as you respond to me. And you're offering these messages, even when you're not speaking. You're presenting a certain face right now that says, here's how I'd like to be seen. And I'm responding to that a little bit inappropriately because I'm singling you out and talking about what you're doing, which is a little embarrassing, right? But then what we're doing in all of our communication here at this level is we're ascribing certain identities to other people. I'm talking to you as if you are this certain kind of person. And you are, and I am, avowing identities for ourselves. I'm pretending to be a certain person, and so are you. So this process is always going on. Ellen is ascribing a certain identity for herself, or I'm sorry, ascribing a certain identity for me and avowing a certain identity for herself, and I'm doing the same thing in reverse. And one way to think about competent communication, especially cross-cultural communication, is when avowals match ascriptions, when you are seen as who you avow to be. I pretend to be this, Karen responds to me as if I am this, and I'm doing the same for her. At a really general level, that's one way to think about competence, is just to be aware of, who does this person want to be in this interaction? Can I treat her as if she is that person? And is she doing the same for me? Now that's not very helpful on a practical level. You don't walk around day to day going, who are you avowing to be at this moment? I'm sorry, honey, I'm ascribing something else to you at the moment. So much of today's session is focused on this idea and making it more concrete. This notion of salience and intensity is also very interesting when it comes to gender roles. Because you can avow, we have a whole series of identities. Why don't you name some of the cultures that you represent? Just name some up. Cultures you represent.
Eastern European Jew.
Okay, so that's part of who you are. Another?
Middle-aged man.
Okay, middle-aged male culture, wonderful.
Mother.
Okay, mother culture.
Grandmother.
Grandmother.
West Coast.
West Coast.
Midwest.
Okay, Midwest. So you're seeing all these cultural identities. Which one's most important to you? What would you identify as of all these things? You don't have to say this out loud, but just think about it. I heard mother just uttered there for a moment. So that one's most salient to you. Is that your voice? Who threw their voice? Who said mother? Thank you. Why did you throw your voice over there? So that's this notion of salience, that among all the identities that we bear and that other people might ascribe to us and that we might avow, some are more salient than others. Some stand out on our landscape more than others. That you really see yourself as a representative of that particular thing. That overall, I think of myself in this interaction as a mother.
Where's the boundary between relationship and culture? mean, like, I think spouse, right? Part of what defines my sense of who I am as a spouse, and yet that's part of the culture. Is it?
Well, there is. I think there is something you get socialized into through bridal showers and conversations before you get married.
See, I flunked all that stuff. I just bombed all that stuff.
Well, that didn't mean it wasn't there, Karen. But there's a purpose for the rituals that we do before men and women get married. Is that it's this chance for people to, whether they're saying it out loud, "I'm passing along to you the wisdom of the culture of married men now," but that's part of what goes on, and I do think that's something we carry around. So, okay, and now I understand your question. Okay. The other piece here is intensity, that we feel to differing degrees that we really ought to defend this particular identity. So that maybe I don't carry Eastern European Jew very heavily, that maybe that's not really central to me, but maybe it is real salient to me. I'm sorry, maybe it's not really salient to me, but maybe I feel very intensely about it. If I hear that particular group being talked down, or demonized in some way, I'm very likely to get my back up and, you know, respond to that particular piece. So that people have, these are just two ways of thinking about the identities that you avow. How central is it to me, and how strongly do I feel called to defend it? Of course, this is true in gender roles, too. Men often will resort to domestic violence just because they feel called to sort of defend maleness, you know, be a man. Being a man is important, and if I'm not standing up for it, then, you know, if I'm not being aggressive and doing the things I think I ought to do, then I'm not really defending my, I've heard it called a race even. I'm not defending my gender like I should. I'm not defending my sex like I should. So,
Jeff, does salient?
What?
You are so good.
You didn't want me to ask a question.
Well, no, but see, if you saw that what written down on a piece of paper, it would sound like a very welcoming sort of response, wouldn't it? You read it on a piece of paper, Jeff, what? You know, it's written right there. Were you reading something into my message?
Any stage direction.
Go ahead, Gloria.
Yeah, you really make me feel like I want to say something. My impression, my feeling is that salience changes at different times. It's not static. It's fluid.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Thank you for pointing that out. That's the word that's key to me in my communication, is that because you knew somebody an hour ago doesn't mean they're in the same conversation now or offering the same avowal of themselves. Maybe they're in a situation where they're more concerned with presenting themselves as a competent businesswoman than a mother. Mm-hmm. Not that the two are different, but that you really would, you know, have one salient identity than others. What?
Can you have unhealthy avowals in the sense that what someone else has ascribed to you, you take on and don't?
Yeah.
That's not really you.
Oh, absolutely.
But you're, you know, the unhealthy part of us says, I need to accept this.
Oh, yeah. There are great studies of self-fulfilling prophecy in classrooms. Famous study many of you may have heard of, a bunch of students were identified, this is in the days before human subjects guidelines for research. A bunch of students were randomly identified to their teachers at the beginning of the school year as genius, wonderful kids. Well, wonderful, yeah, late bloomers. So you really pay attention to those kids, and by the end of the class, those kids were performing wonderfully, even though they weren't. They were just randomly chosen at the beginning of class. And so it can also work in a positive sense, that you can start to avow the identity that others are ascribing to you. And that it's kind of a mysterious process. It also shows you the power you have to help shape, especially children, the identities that people carry around. I find that as a really hopeful thing. Oh, one last thing here. Tony helped me do this. Let's see if we can do it. Thanks, Tony. This is high tech. I'm going to do a stereotypical guy. Thanks, Karen. let's see. One other way to think about relationships is that instead of thinking of relationships as moving through this series of really predictable stages, relationships always involve managing these tensions, these opposites. And that this is true in intercultural relationships, also true in relationships between men and women. So when you think about it, in your relationships with your friends even, but certainly with committed partners and things, you feel called to both independence, you want to be your own person, and interdependence. You want to be known as hooked up with this person, but you also want your own sense of what's going on. Openness and privacy. You want to know that you can share things with the other person, but you don't want to have to share everything with the other person. Or maybe you do. Novelty and predictability. We always have ice cream on Sunday nights. You know, that's predictable, but after a while that becomes a complaint, you know? We always have ice cream on Sunday nights. That we want both. We want some predictability and some novelty. And this one is kind of unique to intercultural relationships. We want to have a satisfying relational identity. We want to be known as Jeff and Emily, but we also want to be known as Jeff and as Emily. We want to have our own unique individual identities. And that if one person gets subsumed by the other, or you're seen only as the relationship, that's also a tension that couples have to deal with. Are we a couple or are we individual? And that's related, but different than this first one. So I find these really interesting things to think about as issues that you wrestle with in a relationship. And you're all looking, see, now you're looking like, what, are you going to get to something useful? Give us something we can use? What I'd like to have you do is, I'm going to go back to this notion here. Of conscious, yeah, very good. This notion right here, of conscious incompetence. And I'd like you, if you would, with a partner, it can be somebody nearby, you don't have to jump up and run around the room today if you don't want to. But I want you to see if you can come up with a time, an incident, of conscious incompetence on your part that had to do with cross-sex communication. You were communicating with somebody who uses a different communication style. If you're masculine style, relatively masculine style, you had an interaction with somebody who uses a feminine style and realized that something was wrong, but you couldn't quite put your finger on it. So if you could just bring one of those to mind and share it with the partner. It helps to just start with the present day and think backwards until you go, oh yeah, I remember that one. Some of you may go back several years and remember one that had a particularly traumatic effect on you. But that might be very good for discussion later. But I'd like, if you would, think about a time when you felt consciously incompetent. You were aware that something wasn't going well and you weren't sure what to do about it. Even if you figured it out later, at the time, you weren't sure about it. What would you like to ask before you try this?
An example.
Oh.
Okay, let's see. Anybody have one? Let's see. Let's say you intended to give your spouse a compliment, and what sounded like a compliment to you caused him to turn on his heel and stalk out of the room.
Okay.
And at the time you were going,
he really meant
this. Yeah, wait a minute, why did that happen? So, okay. And it doesn't have to be something you made sense of later. It could be something you're still confused about, or it could be something you've since worked out. But I'd like to get a little bank of examples here. Okay. Other questions?
You got one.
Okay, go ahead. Please find a partner if you're looking for one. Go like this. Can I borrow you, please? I'd very much like to hear a couple anecdotes. Anybody willing to share a case where you felt consciously incompetent communicating with someone from the other sex? Go ahead, Karen.
We talked about a couple of weird things, so I'm going off the subject just a hair. But one thing, and I thought this might be different than
what you're going off the subject?
Yeah, a little bit. But it's communication. I'm not a communication subject. Me being incompetent and knowing it, so that's why I thought that was good, which is most of the time. But I write a lot of music for my church, and I bring these in as gifts. And one song that I wrote is a baptismal song called "Know You Are a Blessing to Me" that we've sung a couple of times. And the first verse says, talks about every verse, and it ends with "Know You Are a Blessing to Me." It starts with the parents saying, "Know You're a Blessing to Me." The friends of this person saying, "Know You're a Blessing to Me." The world saying, "Know You Are a Blessing to Me." And then God calling this person back home saying, "Know You're a Blessing to Me." It's a Stages of Life kind of song.
Nice.
Like Morning Cry, only not.
Okay.
Anyway, but the first verse, the parents say, "Little one, you complete us. What a gift you will be." We say, "Know You Are a Blessing to Me." And I wrote the song, and everybody loved it. And then we came to our first staff meeting afterwards, and I have a coworker who's gay, and he was so offended by the song. And I should know better. I work with this guy, and I often ask him, you know, what do you think? but he was so offended by why would someone be complete by a child, and how hurtful that was to listen to that song. And he sat with tears running down his face, and just not my intention at all. But a great thing with this, of me knowing how incompetent my words were, and I've changed the song since then.
But recognizing, yeah, the avowal and the description were different.
Right. Terms of, and that everyone is a blessing, and that he was a blessing. That wasn't the message. But anyway, I think it's so great to, when you start to open your world, to realize what other people are thinking and what your words, how they twist them inside. It's very helpful to have somebody to bounce off like that, so I often do.
Especially when words have something to do with identities, as that one clearly did. Identities are really deeply held by everybody. Others, please. Thank you. I hope I feel like grateful after the fact here. I'm glad to hear your story. What else? What's that? Go ahead.
Well, we found out after talking that the reverse holds, where the other person, the way they're responding, could be considered conscious and competence as well. So they always have to think before you talk, so that it doesn't get twisted back onto you.
So kind of preempt it?
Yeah, so it's like a battle almost. You're both talking the same way, and you're not getting anywhere.
Okay. Anticipating more than expressing what you needed to express. Nice. Guys in the back, you had an insight.
Well, I was just observing both of us, and including Jeff up front, give an example. We both could say, yep, I know many times where I've intended one thing, and my wife has received it entirely different. But if you pushed me to give a specific example, I couldn't come up with it. Mm-hmm. Now, and I was observing that the women seemed to be able to really capture this. And I told Steve, I said, I know that if my wife could be here today, instead of downstairs with our daughter, she could have listed a half dozen, just like that.
When you were incompetent?
Yeah, sure. where that communication went like that.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering if women had an easier time identifying specific examples.
No. No, but we can talk about anything else.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Bart.
I thought one, this is not a big one, but it's a typical one. My husband had a blister under the ball of his foot this week, and it was bothering him when he was hiking and walking down. So he was intending to go on another walk. I said, maybe we ought to take care of that blister. No? Oh, then he lets it go. Then he mentioned something about it again, but then he lets it go. So I said, would you like it? Yeah. Okay. So he took care of the blister, bandaged it. He went for his hike. I asked him, how's the blister? You know, it's like, don't nurture me, don't caretake me, it's fine, you know? And so I just gotta let go. You know, if it gets infected, it gets infected. You know, it's just like, back off.
At least he got to maintain the identity as a self-reliant.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, it was nice that, you know,
I had to clean
to
it and bandage it, and cricket, but once that was done,
Right. And you've been married 32 years as of tomorrow, is that
yeah.
correct? So it can happen. Go ahead.
A professor of ours, he and his wife done a lot of marriage care work, and one of the stories that they shared was he hated to be in the kitchen because he did not like he felt very intimidated by the kitchen. And so in their relationship, they worked it out that Nita would always do the cooking. And one night, they were both reading in the living room. He went into the kitchen and started making popcorn. Nita was so shocked, she went and looked at the door, and she was thinking how wonderful that was, that he finally felt comfortable enough to go in the kitchen and to do something in there. And he read it as, she's sitting there judging me. So he snapped at her. And that was not her intent at all. Her intent was to communicate support.
Great example. That's a great example. You had one, and you had one, and let's move on.
Well, compared to what was said, I think I came up with more of them than she did. But probably one that the first one that came to mind was my relationship with my granddaughter. no matter what I say, I'm incompetent at saying it because of her reaction to me.
How old is she?
She's 14.
Oh, something teen is she?
Something teen. But that's part of it, I suppose. But it just continues. I think I got it now. And I approached and bang, it's not. I'm just totally incompetent at dealing with that, while other people are very competent at handling that.
And part of that, too, is a generational difference, not just the size difference. We've got all this stuff going on, all these identities to negotiate. Thank you. Sure.
I have a teen one.
Okay, thank you.
If I'm walking, say I usually wear just, because I really don't care what everybody anyways, just sloppy clothes or whatever, sweatpants to school, and I walk down the hall, and that's usually my everyday routine. And then one day I decide to put on a skirt and blow dry my hair or put on makeup, and either one of my parents says, "Oh, you look so pretty today. Wow, you should do that every day." And depending on my mood, I can either go, "Oh, thanks, that's so nice, I spent all this time," or, "How dare you say that I look horrible every other day."
Well, we know some things about men and women and how they communicate. These are really characteristic kinds of incompetencies that we feel as we're trying to communicate across sexes. We talked yesterday that women speak and hear a code of connection and intimacy, that that's what communication is for, and that's what a feminine style is schooled to listen for, is this connection and intimacy. That's why we use symbols with each other. Men hear a code and speak a code of status and independence. So the popcorn example is just a terrific one to illustrate the difference here. You know, the wife is really pleased that the husband's finally in the kitchen making popcorn, that he's overcome his fear of the kitchen and he's in there doing something. And that, you know, she would see it as, "Oh, great, you know, now we're at this, you know, we've got this connection going, I'm pleased for you, I'm proud of you." And he sees her as kind of, you know, scoping it out, making sure he's not getting things too dirty or overseeing or going to give him advice or something, which really is status and independence really at risk there. So the same words being interpreted, same acts being interpreted in different ways. So we know that about men's and women's communication styles, masculine and feminine communication styles, in much the same way that we know about the communication styles characteristic of different cultures. So you think of, it's okay to think about masculine and feminine as cultures in that regard, that they have distinct communication styles. One other thing to think about is that nonverbal communication, not just verbal communication, not just the words, but the nonverbal stuff, including the vocal stuff, including the stuff that comes out of your mouth but isn't words, pitch and volume and things like that, and what you choose to add to your voice or take away from it. All those things vary also across cultures. And really, they can vary in three different ways, three different kinds of variance that can happen. And I'd ask you to keep in mind men and women when you look at this list, as we apply this to different cultures, but let's see if we can apply it productively to men and women too. First of all, nonverbal communication varies in its repertoire. The different cultures encode different things in nonverbal communication, and some don't use any channels at all, whereas other groups might use those channels. For example, touch. I had a Finnish uncle, a great uncle, Toivo, over on New York Mills, Minnesota, and I never saw him touch anything except a cow, really. That touch isn't part of his repertoire. It's not something he uses. It's not in his nonverbal toolkit. And he was, you know, he's Finnish-American, which and part of it, but he was also a man, and that was a very important part of his identity as a man. Touch was not a big part of his repertoire. And that's one of the things actually we know about men and women, is that when men use touch, it's often for purposes of status and dominance, that you would touch someone as a way of sort of invading their space and showing that, you know, you have the right to do that. Not always, but men are more inclined to do that than women are. Women are less are more likely to be touched than men are. Men are less likely to be touched by other people in society. So that's one difference we know about. Anyway, we can vary in our repertoire. We can also vary in our display rules for nonverbal communication. An example we used when talking about this interculturally was grief and how grief gets shown in different cultures. Norwegian grief looks different than Palestinian grief, for example. The rules for how you show it really kind of vary along a continuum. Should you be restrained? Should you be incredibly effusive? We do the same thing with affection. You know, you run across, if you're a Scandinavian American and you visit someone you've met once before, maybe in Italy, and they're glad to see you, and you sort of stand there and endure it while they hug you and give you big kisses, and kiss you and whatever else they do. So we have display rules that vary from culture to culture in terms of what it's okay to do. And last, we really have variations in meaning. So we might have the same nonverbal behaviors in our repertoire. We might even have similar display rules, but really they might mean the same. They might mean very different things in different cultures. An example we talked about last week is Turkish men. It's really common in Turkish culture for men to hold hands, just as a matter of course. You'd be having a conversation like, you mind doing it? If I was having a conversation with Tony, the whole time we'd be conversing, we'd be sitting here holding hands while we do that. And then, thank you, but that doesn't mean, doesn't mean we're gay. But it's really a difficult, it's really a difficult thing to interpret cross-culturally because it doesn't necessarily mean what you're used to seeing it mean. I remember watching the South Korea, South Korea, Turkey, World Cup soccer match for third place this year. And at the end of the game, it was a very good game, and at the end of the game, end of the match, I guess. What do you say, end of the test, end of the match? What's the appropriate noun for soccer? Match, at the end of the match, they were holding hands in twos and threes, walking across the field so they could salute the crowd together. And it was real companionable hand-holding. It's not like they had to do it, they didn't have to direct each other to the other side of the field. Here, follow me. But that they were doing it because it felt companionable, and both of those cultures are cultures where that was reasonable to do. And I know of a couple members of, male members of my culture who thought that was kind of creepy. They were uncomfortable watching it, even though it didn't mean what was making him feel creepy. So our meanings can differ, too. This is also true across sexes. That our repertoires differ, our display rules differ, and our interpretations and meanings differ for nonverbal behaviors. And so men, we are maybe socialized to be less effusive in our grief, for example, than women. We ought to be the shoulder that is leaned upon rather than the head that is leaning upon the shoulder at the funeral. You're the person who ought to be upright. You ought to be able to make it through most of your eulogy, and then maybe your voice can break right near the end. That's okay. That we give ourselves permission to do that kind of thing. Whereas women, it would be okay to be so broken up that you couldn't speak at all. And for men, that would be less okay. You really ought to be able to get it together to speak a little bit. So our display rules are different, and we have different meanings for different behaviors. A couple other code differences here, just to talk about nonverbal communication, and then move into what it means to be competent. One is we differ in how we use space. Proxemics is the study of proximity, how we use space. Men tend to invade women's space more than the other way around. Again, men use space like we use touch. We use it to exercise kind of dominance in our place in society more than women do. And men also, this is an interesting finding, men tend to have more spaces in the house that are just theirs, that are a little harder for other people to enter, like a workshop or a den. That are, or a chair even. Dad has a chair. That's Dad's chair. Does Mom have a chair?
Yes. Grandma has.
Grandma. By the time you get to be Grandma, maybe you say, you know what? I get a chair now.
And a room.
But a lot of studies of this kind of stuff in the U.S., men are much more likely to have spaces that are their own than women are, and that's a marker. Face and body motion, women tend to condense their body size and often tip their heads a little bit, and that's a gesture of submission. So you take up less space and tip your head a little bit in conversation. Men are less likely to do that, the argument goes. Men are socialized to be more erect and to take up more space. And that it's okay for men to kind of sit on a couch like this. That's what you're supposed to do. It's very seldom you come into a lady's tea at the Lutheran church and see Faces are interesting too with eyes. Women are socialized to really, feminine style relies on eyes a lot, and male style is too, but women look into each other's eyes a lot more than men do. And when men do it, it's interpreted as what? When a man looks into another man's eye and it's not a sexual advance, what is it intended to be?
Control,
confrontation, power. Challenge. That's how you let somebody know, hey. Okay, you shoot daggers at it with your eyes. But generally, men avoid eye contact, whereas women tend to have more eye contact with each other as part of that style. And paralanguage really differs also. Women are socialized to do things with their voice that are inviting and welcoming and tentative. We have all these ways of signaling that with our tone. Mm-hmm. teaching public speaking as I do, one of the hardest things to break women speakers of is this tendency to finish sentences like this. So even when you have good evidence and have made a good claim,
yes,
you still sound kind of uncertain about what you're saying. And you just try and get them to go like this, you know? Very good. You know, that there's this way of doing things with your voice that also can signal more this greater sense of tentative. And men, of course, do something that's a little bit the opposite.
I have a question.
What is it?
We just teach men to listen differently.
Well, listen.
I thought we were.
No, but it is. It's sort of, once again, the way the women do it is wrong. So if they learn to do it like men, it'll be right.
Is that really what you hear me saying?
And now.
Yeah. We'll be talking later. So glad you came to my session. That's not the message I intend to give. Here is, I want to start with a general notion of competence.
But yeah, and how do you check out the misinterpretations? For instance, the reaction you have to the question, what? I mean, women reacted differently than men to that sentence of yours.
So the what thing?
Yes.
Okay.
And when do you have a chance of checking it out? You know, it's like, I'm joking. It's like, oh, right, you know, you have a talk afterwards. But in everyday conversation, we build upon misinterpretation, misunderstandings. And the tendency of women is like, okay, I will just breathe it through it. And it ends up building and building and building. And men will just, you know, brush it off their shoulders. And so you see how important it is,
yes,
to get it straightened out. So what do you really mean with your what? Is that supposed to be a joke? Or is that supposed to be, you know, say, oh, excuse me, but I really was moving into something else right now. So straightening it out, I think, is very helpful. Especially in relationships.
I have three responses.
Wow.
One is, I thought you all did a marvelous job of checking it out in a public setting, that all three of you, and Kira, I don't know if you were involved in it, no, I couldn't tell whether you were part of the figuring out what happened after the what, but that you all did, you participated in a really common cultural script in North America, which is to sort of start laughing and really still push the agenda and get it out there, but in a funny way, like, oh, well, now I feel really welcome, instead of saying, oh, what did you mean by that what? That which we would be is my second response. That would be an appropriate thing to do in conversation with another person. And it's less appropriate in a situation like this. In North American, you know, large group settings, you're supposed to like do these things out loud and laugh while you do them. But in private conversation, you would do something called perception checking, which is where you would say, I just heard you say what with kind of an abrupt tone of voice. Are you joking, or did you really, do you resent the question? But that's something you would do in conversation. That's an interpersonal skill. And my third response is, yes, indeed, I was joking. I was trying to play, and apparently playfulness may have been misinterpreted. So I guess I'll talk to you later, too. I don't know what I'm doing. Sweetie, could you turn off the... Thank you, sweetie. All right, I want to introduce you to just a general way of thinking about being competent across cultures, including incompetent across sexes as you communicate. There's this idea called face work that says, it's based on this metaphor that Irving Goffman came up with in the 1950s. He says, competent social interaction of any kind is like a theater play, and that everybody wants to keep it moving. Nobody wants to have a line drop. And if somebody drops a line, somebody does a faux pas, people help, right? You don't try and make the faux pas worse, but that our real internal social drive is that we want to help the person. Somebody drops their book, you think, all right, let's see, what's the appropriate thing here? Should I help them? Somebody bumps their head. You know, does everybody go running over and say, hey, okay! You know, well, maybe you do sometimes. Maybe there are other times where you don't. The important thing is that you don't want to interrupt the flow too much. We really like to keep the flow going. And so the idea is that we're always offering, again, we're avowing certain identities. We're offering these things. Goffman called them faces. That I'm offering a face in my communication, and you're offering faces in your communication. And that competent face work means that I affirm your face even as my face is affirmed by you. And that we keep on talking with each other as if we are the people we're pretending to be. And we may feel those to be very genuine identities. I don't mean to say that we're faking it. but that Goffman says, you want to be competent, pay attention to the fact that people are negotiating face. Here's the piece I'd like you to see right here. The argument is that this is a universal urge to maintain face, to seem as though you are this person, and that there are these three fundamental needs that are also argued to be universal. Now, we vary culturally in terms of how much we need a particular need to be met, but that these three needs are thought to be pretty universal. One is a need to be respected, to be seen as competent. So I'll present a face that helps me be seen as competent. The need to be accepted, to be to belong, to be part of the group rather than being an outlier. So I'll present myself as if I'm in rather than out. And a need for autonomy. I want to be seen as somebody who has a sense of choice-making freedom, and I'm not just directed by other people. Now again, do you think men and women differ in the ratio of these needs? Based on what you know about men's and women's communication styles, what would you think is different?
Women would probably tend to need more acceptance and men more autonomy.
And that's what research would support you in that presumption. So that, first of all, when you're dealing with someone who has a masculine style, for example, recognize that of these three needs, this is one that's real prominent, that's going to be part of most male avowal in the U.S., and this is going to be real prominent, part of female avowal, feminine avowal in the U.S. That's really important. Now, it's not as simple as it seems. When you look at this, when you're doing face work, you have to deal with some other tensions, some other opposites that sometimes exist when you're doing face work with people. For example, you've got to satisfy your own face needs while you're satisfying other people's at the same time. And sometimes those are in conflict. You want to present yourself as competent, yet maybe you're trying to correct for a faux pas that happened earlier. So how do you do that? How do you build up the other person as competent without somehow threatening your own autonomy or sense of competence in the eyes of the other person? So that's one paradox that's out there. Supporting one aspect of your own face might threaten another one, okay? Or somebody else's face. I might try and offer a student a compliment, for example, in a class, and some students find that a threat to their acceptance by their peers, for example. Oh no, don't point me out of class as having done something smart, then I'll just get teased the rest of the day. I mean, that's the script you hear in the pen. Don't point out that I'm actually doing well because then my buddies won't hang out with me or they'll make fun of me. That kind of thing. So you can, there's all kinds of face trouble that can come up just from these sorts of things. But competence should include the ability of a person to negotiate mutually satisfying, mutually acceptable identities in interaction. So that means, first of all, you have to be aware of what the other person's trying to be. And it probably has something to do with these things. Okay. And you have to be able to respond to that. So really competence involves those two processes. One is awareness and the other is response. Can you see it? And do you know how to respond to it? There's some other things that are more specific that I'd like to share with you, because this one I think you might find more concrete. Really four components of successful intercultural communication. If you think about these in light of cross-sex communication, let's see if they apply. First of all, the most important piece is you have to want to communicate competently across sexes. If it's not of interest, none of the rest of this matters. And men, we're in the privileged position in society. We have less motivation to do this because we can maintain our position in society as relatively privileged members without being motivated to communicate competently across sexes. It might cost us some things relationally, but feminists argue that really women have a better handle on how the system works because they're in a less privileged position and they're more motivated to communicate competently because it's in their interest to improve their position in society. So motivation is one thing. Maybe it's more of a struggle for men. Second, it's important to have different kinds of knowledge. First, just what do you know about people in general? Okay, how do people respond to different situations? Not a particular person, but just what sort of empathy do you have for humans? Second, what do you know about your own strengths and weaknesses and how you're perceived as a communicator? Okay, how self-aware are you? What kind of self-knowledge do you have about how you communicate with other people, especially with people of the opposite sex, when we use a style different than yours? What knowledge do you have about particular others? Okay, what do you know about the partner with whom you're trying to communicate? And how well do you know the code? I call it linguistic knowledge, but you could really think of it as how well do you know the code? Do you know the code used by feminine users I can't think of another noun there. Do you understand the masculine code? Very well. So motivation and knowledge are two of four pieces that are real important. There's some attitudes that are really key to intercultural competence. One is, you have to be able to tolerate ambiguity. If you're going to Italy, you have to understand that you're not going to understand everything that's going on, and that you really need to be okay with that. Okay? Vonda asked me this morning, how's your knowledge of Portuguese? I have not even one Portuguese word in my vocabulary. So if I were to go to Brazil, I would have a relatively difficult time if I had little tolerance for ambiguity. Same is true for dealing with communication across sexes. If I feel like I have to understand entirely everything about my sweet spouse, I'm going to be really in dire straits. And so I have to sort of lower my expectations about the clarity and certainty that especially a masculine style really craves, and really get a tolerance for ambiguity there. You also have to have the ability to imagine yourself in another person's shoes to be really, truly competent. That's why kids often really have to struggle to become competent, because the only awareness they have developmentally is of themselves for a long time. And then they start to open up, and that's one of the surest signs of maturity, is when they start to be able to self-reflect and when they start to be able to put themselves in other people's positions. They become more other than self-centered. And last, non-judgmentality is an important attitude. The shorthand for this in terms of competence across sexes, I found, is just to say, put the kindest possible reading on whatever the other person is doing that confuses you, rather than the most malign reading. They aren't necessarily out to get you. Pardon?
That's in the catechism. That's what they get, best instruction on everything.
That's nice. So we have attitudes that we are schooled in the church that actually help us to be better cross-sex communicators.
May
I say something? Yeah, of course. Please.
In your last statement about how we internalize or how we hear and place best instruction on it, I think a lot of the ability to do that depends on what kind of feeling you have about yourself. And if you are not so, if you don't love yourself very much, it's hard to not hear things as accusatory or demeaning or shaming, or so it might be even more difficult to put the best construction on it. And if you're in the female language system, where it's more into sensitivity and that kind of thing, that impacts it even more. I mean, that just adds another heavy brick on it.
I can see that. That's an excellent point. There are all kinds of influences on our ability to have these attitudes. And it sounds as though, from your standpoint, people who use a feminine style, many people who use a feminine style, maybe have even a greater handicap to overcome if they're going to be truly able to own those kinds of attitudes. Yeah.
To be able to see, to look at the one that really struck me is the man coming from his meaning for being an authority and not feeling defensive. It was a couple of them back.
Oh,
but to understand, oh, this is a man communicating from his culture of authority.
And you wouldn't want to say that necessarily to a man who's beating you up. You wouldn't want to have empathy for somebody who's exerting physical power.
But even if it's in a work relationship or whatever, but a woman from her culture and her perspective may not be able to see that, but rather will see it as demeaning, derogatory, because of what's inside who she is.
Yep, and that really gets in the way of a feeling and a sensing of being competent, doesn't it?
And then you ask, and then the man doesn't want to be asked any more questions, isn't it plain and simple? You know, so then you've got this going this way.
Well, and a big part of what we're doing today, I'm applying an intercultural communication model to cross-sex communication. And it's not something that's done very much. And Gloria's pointing out a place where maybe it doesn't work very well. Maybe it doesn't fit as well. Maybe what we expect of one another as men and women is different than what we expect of each other as members of different cultures. And that maybe there are too many socio-political pieces to make this as feasible as it may be at first blush. I want to share this last bit of information with you, just to see if you see any of these as at all useful in communicating across sexes. These are some behaviors that seem to work best across all cultures, and you recognize that some of them are not behaviors per se. For example, display of respect, that's not a behavior, that's a category of behavior. But that seems to be really key to navigating successfully in virtually any culture. And the trick, again, is knowing how is respect enacted in this culture? What does respect look like? What should you do? Interaction management means you have to know how it is that members of a particular culture decide turn-taking in a conversation. How do you know when it's your turn? How do you enter a conversation? Do you know how to do that? How do you get in? Some people just have a big intake of breath. Other people go, ha. You know those kinds of things. Sometimes when you're in a really masculine culture, you don't wait for space. You have to make your own space. And if you don't know that, and you're in the midst of a real masculine culture, you don't get to participate at all. And you can also be incompetent if you take a masculine style into a very feminine listening kind of environment. That can be really difficult, too. Tolerance for ambiguity again, empathy again, relational rather than task behavior. In many cultures now, not necessarily in gender culture, but in many nations, they privilege relational communication much more than getting things done communication, as we do in America. We're really focused on having conversations about things rather than just conversing to get close to each other. And that if you privilege the relational over the task, perhaps you're more likely to be seen as competent in other cultures. I'm not sure whether this applies to gender or not. And interaction posture is just how do you approach interaction with someone? Not just how you get into and run a conversation, but how is it you decide with whom and in what ways to be in contact with people? Is it appropriate just to go up and stand near someone? Should you strike up a conversation in the grocery checkout? Is that part of what you ought to do? And again, that can vary, I think, across cultures. I'm not sure about cross sexes.
Can you go back to me?
No.
Talk more about...
Well, yes.
Okay.
I'm joking. Talk about what?
The relational over task.
Yes.
Was it first glance that seems to me feminine rather than masculine?
Do you want to say more?
No, I want to hear what you have to say.
Yes. I would agree with you that this is, America is, we really value autonomy a lot. We're kind of outliers that way in terms of many of the other cultures on Earth. And so as a result, we tend to really value, we devalue the relational kind of talk, the stuff that connects us, because it's more important to be successful and kind of stand out than it is to be connected with family and with other groups of people for long periods of time. So I think you're right in saying that you might be more competent interculturally if you were comfortable adopting more of a feminine way of viewing communication when you travel to other countries. Now, I'm not sure about what this means regarding how to communicate between men and women. I'm not sure what kind of difference it would make. Do you have a response?
I think how I read that is underneath the respect, learning to understand each other's differences or different approaches. When I lived in Minnesota, there was a growing Hispanic Latino presence in many communities. Many of them were working on the packing plants for turkey processing. And if there was a holiday or especially some kind of family emergency, one of them came from Rio Grande Valley or some from Mexico, some from Nicaragua. If there was a family emergency, they got word of it. They were gone. They wouldn't show up for work for 2-3 weeks. And, the managers were getting frustrated because in the Anglo culture, you get permission to leave before you go. Because, we value the task more than the relationship.
Right.
But for them, they value the relationship more than the task. And so if the jobs were there when they came back, it didn't make any difference to be another job. Because the relationship was of more value. And it took the religious community to kind of bring some of the business community together with the Hispanic Latino community to say, you guys are looking at this from very different cultures, cultural perspectives, and how can you understand and communicate in a way that'll be beneficial to both of you. So but I see that with men and women as well. Maybe linked also to the motivation. You have to want to learn from the other perspective in order to understand how you're communicating, how you can communicate more effectively.
I agree with you. It's interesting, all last week when we were talking about intercultural communication, so many of the examples were from intersex communication incidents, and now today we're veering back into intercultural as we try to understand cross-sex communication. I want to leave you just with one more bit of information, realizing we're leaving some questions unanswered here. But I find this to be really good advice for myself in my communication with people who have a code different than mine. Perhaps I should have turned the light on and then put this up. That was a smart move.
You can do it.
You can raise your hand. It helps to know yourself. It helps to enjoy learning about other people, that learning is, in fact, as important as asserting your own point of view, even though maybe it's a struggle, especially for masculine users. Make it sound like heroin, don't I? Masculine users. Learn to respect cultural differences. That means I may be more tolerant of my spouse's communication style if I think of her as just belonging to a perfectly legitimate culture, a way of speaking, not that she's just being difficult. That we strive for empathy, avoid enacting patterns of dominance. So if you recognize you do a lot of touching to create space for yourself and dominance, maybe you should think about that. Be reflexive about how you use touch with people, for example. Make spaces for the other people in your house, perhaps. And share responsibility for ethics. Everybody's got some universal will toward principle, but there aren't really universal codes of wonderful behavior, and that you really need to sort of negotiate that stuff with each other. So I have to say, I think this advice is relatively general. But the biggest insight I found to be useful, again, is just to think of feminine style as a unique culture for me, as a masculine, relatively masculine style user. And that if I think of it that way, I tend to be more forgiving. The rest of this stuff tends to come along. I think of it as another land, another country, instead of just a difficulty I have to deal with as a person. So thanks. I hope this starts some other conversations for you.